Well, the scoreboard said I lost today, but what the scoreboard doesn't say is what it is I have found.
Welcome back to the Tennis Connected Studios for November 21st, 2016. I'm Nima Naderi alongside Parsa Sammy, and we're here this week to review the ATP World Tour Finals. This week's podcast is brought to you by Grand Slam Tennis Tours. Make sure to hit them up for the Australian Open coming up in January for all your ticket and traveling needs. Let's introduce this week's co-host, Parsa. How are you this week, buddy?
Doing great. How are you?
Very good. Finally getting some snow here in Toronto, which is quite depressing for me, but I just looking forward. I think for me, Australia gives me some hope because there's a lot of sun there. And then after that, I really look forward to Indian Wells because there's a lot of, you feel that warmth coming in and spring is around the corner. So just got to tough it out for, three or four more months and then we can really get back into some sun. But with all of that said, Parsa, men's season concluded yesterday with Andy Murray defeating Novak Djokovic in a comprehensive fashion, let's be quite honest. I mean, straight sets. Last game was very riveting and back and forth, but nevertheless, it was a 3-4 score line, which to me is pretty comprehensive when you have the number one and two players in the world. Murray, as we all know, has ended number one now, won his fifth title in a row, and his first ATP World Tour title as well to cap off an absolutely sensational season, which, going through halfway of it, we thought there was absolutely no way that Murray could end number one with the dominance that Djokovic had shown through Australia, through Miami, through Indian Wells, and through the French Open and the clay court season. So now you have a situation where Djokovic looks kind of disinterested. And, what did you make of the whole dynamic of the match and, as a whole, and, how we're going to look forward towards this rivalry between Murray and Novak?
I mean, clearly you don't have the ironclad. Djokovic is no longer in form, and it's hard, right? When you become a dominant player and then you are not as dominant, it becomes fairly obvious to the world that's clearly something is not the same. And then at the same time, you look at a guy who took an opportunity and has reversed his fortune, and he became the dominant in-form guy. And I mean, anyone who ever finishes number one in the world at the end of the year deserves it, obviously, right? Because they have the most ranking points and the most, big match wins or whatever it is. But man, Murray deserves this thing. He saw a small opportunity and he blew this thing wide open and just ran all the way to the finish line. Dare I say, I'm almost like proud of him, Nima. It's weird, right? Because I have no association with him. I don't know him, nothing. But I'm proud of what he showed the world about the effort and the resiliency. He's been under the radar, getting to U.S. Open finals for his entire career, always losing in slam finals, always being second fiddle, then having a nice blip a couple years back where it showed like he was going to round into form, and then sort of having back surgery and going back, under the covers, so to say. And boom. There he is again. He sees this crack right around the Wimbledon time this year, sees Djokovic not the same, and he brings Lendl back on board, and they say, okay, I'm going to be out there to win every tournament and do this. This is my one chance to be number one in the world, and he did it. I mean, for me, it's the same pride I feel in if you'd say to me, hey, Parsa, I'm going to go climb Mount Everest, or I want to run the New York City Marathon, and I watch you through 6 months of progress of preparing yourself for those feats and achievement, and then you go and do it. It's like, it's an amazing thing to see. And we got to witness that with Andy Murray this year.
Yeah, I mean, Parsa, let's run this down. The guy won Wimbledon. He won the Olympic gold medal. Didn't play Toronto. Made the finals of Cincy. Lost to Cilic. Lost in the quarters of the U.S. Open to Nishikori. Lost to Delpo in Davis Cup. And then from there, He goes to Beijing, wins. Goes to Shanghai, wins. Goes to Vienna, wins. Goes to Paris, wins. Goes to London, wins. These are not small tournaments. You know what I mean? It's just a monumental effort, phenomenal effort, really. And, you know, I think the one thing, we got to bring Yvon Lendl into the mix here because he's back in the equation. And, you know, lo and behold, this guy's winning everything now. And I think a lot of it has to do with not necessarily any technical changes or anything like that, but it's just the mentality that Lendl brought forth. And one thing that I know of, I mean, the only, you know, I can only go on the information that I've been given or I've read or seen, is that he said, you got to bring it every single week. You know, that means you got to bring it in Vienna. You got to bring it in Cincinnati. And I think at the top levels, that's really where the number one ranking is held, right? Because, yeah, all these guys are going to play pretty well in slams, win, make semis, make finals, you know, whatever it is. But when you, you know, those points, you look at the point differential right now. Forgive me if I'm wrong, everybody, but I think Murray ended the year about 500-600 points ahead of Djokovic, right? So it's not like he blew him away. And obviously that's because Djokovic had a phenomenal year himself, except for the last, you know, 4 or 5 months. But it's those tournaments like the, you know, the Beijings and the Viennas that really helped propel him over that marker. And that's why he played those tournaments. Otherwise, he really didn't need to play Vienna or Beijing. And, you know, if it's not that close next year, I would be shocked if you see him at those tournaments. But, you know, that's, he did what he had to do. He put his head down. He played whoever was in front of him. He beat everybody who was in front of him. And the last guy, how fittingly, was the one guy that he hasn't played in a long time, relatively since, I believe, the French Open Finals. And he defeated him, too, in straight sets. And, you know, he deserves everything that he has. And let's give a quick shout-out to his brother, Jamie, because he's the number one doubles player in the world. So, you know, Christmas is going to be, you know, pumping at their house this December. It's just going to be phenomenal. And what an effort for the Murray clan and the Murray family and, you know, Judy Murray and Murray's father, who I believe is also getting married. And Murray alluded to that he's going, him and his brother will be going to his dad's bachelor party. They're going to hang out with some 50 to 65-year-old guys. So it looks like, you know, a lot of good times ahead for the Murray family. And, you know, we'll look forward to that. So, Parsa, you know, let's change gears now to 2017. So we have this year in the bag. What do you see on the horizon in Australia now as our next focal point for the tennis community here? Do you see Murray going in there dominating? He's made 5 finals, never won that tournament. Djokovic has won it 5 or 6 times, so he's going to be the favorite there. But is he going to be the favorite? And then, you know, how about a guy like Milos Raonic? What are your some thoughts on the other guys in the equation as we move forward to 2017?
Yeah, I mean, really difficult to see how you know, anyone's going to respond to the off season. You know, you knew it was going to be Agassi's time. Like, is Djokovic going to go home and regroup and start over? Is he going to go out and do the same things? Is Murray going to be celebrating, and has he adopted this mindset as something as a lifestyle change, or is it directly due to having someone in his corner? And if that person decides not to continue, then is that process over with? There's a lot of questions that we obviously can't answer. You know, is Stan going to go back to the drawing board? Is Federer with his new little hairdo, like back when he was younger, is he going to come out like a ninja warrior and decide that, you know what, this is my taking and we're going to go after this, you know, like I was 22. I think there's a lot of interesting plot twists that are going to be happening. I think you're going to have the emergence of Nishikori and Raonic, and I think a couple of the young guns are going to have another solid season. At the same time, it's going to be a lot about who has put in what kind of work. Like, you know, a name you didn't mention was Nadal. Is Nadal for sure done? I mean, that's a question that we're going to tell in Australia. I think the most important person in the world this tournament is going to be Rafael Nadal, because if he can't hit that forehand with the same revolutions, his career is done. So he's got a few months here. He's taken, even though he's healthy, he's taken his last few months off, and he's working on precisely that. And, you know, it's going to be a big telltale sign for him in Australia. You know, nothing less than, I would say, a semifinal is going to be acceptable. So, I mean, there's a lot riding there and a lot for his future. You know, when I look at Milos, we were talking off air, Nima, and, you know, Milos is at a career high, number 3 in the world. That's amazing. And, you know, but he clearly still has that limitation. Watching that match Even though Milos had his own match point against Murray in the semis, it was like, you know, if his serve wasn't going to be the greatest of all time serve, he wasn't going to win off the ground. I think Murray was winning a solid percentage off the ground, maybe, you know, 54% or something like that. So almost more than every other rally was going towards Murray's corner. And Milos' serve needed to be that much more dominant against a guy who puts a lot of returns in play. And so it becomes this limitation. And can he overcome this limitation? Can he serve so big that he can overcome his awkward athleticism? Because Milos has clearly put in the work. He's starting to maximize. I'm getting a feeling that he's maximizing, which is not a good feeling or not a good thing for him, in that he's number three in the world and he's starting to maximize. You know, that's a problem. So what is he going to do to overhaul his game, to make those changes necessary in order to be successful at the highest level? Because can we expect a quarterfinal, semifinal run for Milos at Australia? Probably. I think his number three ranking is just. I think he is exactly that. But what's he going to do, Nima? But what is it going to be? Is it going to be a more aggressive second serve? Is he going to attack the net more? Is he going to you know, do something like I don't know. I was about to say Karlovic's renaissance, in that Karlovic, you know, has a specific plan on what he's trying to do, but Karlovic can't beat the top guys. Mm-hmm. You have to do more than that to beat the top guys. So I don't know, Nima. It's very debatable on what he can actually do and what buttons he can push. I'm happy that seems like McEnroe was out of his corner. I think that was a bad decision, but I think he seems to be back on track now. I think he's in the right frame of mind. He's more relaxed. He looked like he had a definitive plan on what he was trying to do, and I think it needs one more turn, and I'm not sure where it's going to come from, and that's the point with Milos there.
So
So
I mean, Parse, obviously amazing points. You know, for me, you know, I've debated this with Casey Curtis. You know, as we mentioned before, good friend of ours. He's Milos Raonic's coach from the ages of 8 to 17. So I mean, he had a major, you know, position in developing his technique and his persona and all everything that he has there. And he's still a firm believer that you should be hitting your second serve at 80% of your first serve. So if you have a 100-mile-an-hour first serve, your second serve should be 80 miles an hour. And you know, as I mentioned, you know, to you off air, you know, you got Milos hitting 136 mile an hour first serve, and he's hitting 92 mile an hour second serves. And there's no reason why his second serve shouldn't be 115 to 118. Now, what I'm trying to say is that to me should not be a maximization. That should be his standard, and it can be his standard. Because if you looked at Wimbledon this year, his first cup, like his third, I believe third and fourth round or second and third round, his average second serve pace was around 118, 119. And he was just rolling there. And I think that's like, that has to be his norm. Because, you know, human speed, foot speed, cannot catch up with these shots. And especially on a faster surface like grass, or, you know, something like Shanghai, a hard court, you know, which is a very, or Dubai, these type of surfaces, you know, you got to come out and play your guns. Because I've, you know, how much has Milos worked on his volleys? He's worked on them a ton. He's brought in McEnroe. I know he's doing all these agility things, but he doesn't have the athleticism to get below the level of the net, open up his racket face and control the shots and do all of these things. And that's just a limitation. You know what I mean? A guy like Nishikori can do that. You know what I mean? I know you marvel in his athleticism and what he can do, but Milos is not Nishikori. You know, you got even a guy like Jerzy Janowicz, big guy, right? 6'8", 6'9", whatever he is, very good mover. You look at a guy like Riley Opelka, who hopefully we'll be able to speak with in a couple weeks' time. He's another guy who's a great athlete for his height, right? He very good backhand, good forehand. I don't think he has those athletic limitations. Obviously, he's a big unit. He's not going to move like a guy like Nishikori, but he's still a better athlete than Milos. So with everything that Milos has done, and what I really agree with what you said, is he's number three in the world. He's behind Andy Murray, who's been on an absolute tear this year. He's behind Novak Djokovic at two, who's won 12 Grand Slams, numerous other finals. Amazing athlete, super flexible, moves well. He's like Gumby out there. What is Milos going to do to get to number two, number one? Well, first of all, he's like I said, I think the only thing he can really do is just go at 100% power and try to just blow through these guys, because he's not going to do it with finesse. He's not going to do it with foot speed. You look at any rally over 5 or 6 shots against either Djokovic or Murray, I think he's done. You know what I'm saying? He's not Nadal in his pomp where he's going to go out there and run around his backhand and crush forehands down the line, or Federer's transition game where you don't even know how he got to the net. He doesn't have that. So it has to be sheer power. Like, you got Murray's second serve, go for it. Even Djokovic, his second serve. You got to crack that thing, go for everything, and that's it. I don't think it's going to get much worse for him. He's not going to all of a sudden go down to 25 in the world if he does that. Right, he's still going to beat the guys that he should beat. But if he wants to beat those 2 or 3 guys who are ahead of him, I think it has to be all-out aggression all the time. And that will become his norm, in my opinion. The more you practice...
It's like a similar debate, though, to what we had with Federer and Nadal, right? With Federer and Nadal on clay.
Yeah.
You know, what should he do with that second serve return? You know, why is he chipping it? Why he should be hitting it and coming in? And the truth of the matter is that Will Milos against Jerzy Janowicz take a second serve and hit it at 118 miles an hour? Maybe he will, because he's no pressure, because he knows he's going to win the next point against Jerzy Janowicz. But against Djokovic, maybe it's you know, something psychological. Maybe it's a plan, or against Murray, you know. It's all very, very debatable, and the only way to really know is for him to go out there and try and attempt to do it. You know, it's extremely tricky territory. In that, what is the worst that can happen? Well, the worst that can happen is a real thing. He can drop to 7 or 8 in the world, and I think he probably doesn't want to ever go back there again. And you look at why. You know, Nima, let me ask you the question: Why is Milos number 3 in the world?
I think. Well, first of all, he works extremely hard. And
no, but not in terms of like his characteristics and work ethic. Because if you're in the top 10, if you're a professional athlete, you probably have a lot of good things about you as a human being.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
In terms of strengths of a personality or whatever. But literally, what makes him number 3 in the world in terms of physical?
Well, I think first of all, he's strong. He's not working hard, but he's a physically strong guy. His calves are as big as my head, so he's a huge guy. He's got a tremendous serve. He can hit over 145 miles an hour. He can hit big second serves if he chooses to. I hope he continues to do that. He's got probably one of the best inside-out forehands in the game. He's worked on his backhand. He's worked on his slice. He's worked on his approach shots. And he's working on his volleys. So he's a big unit at the net. He's tough to pass. And, I mean, obviously, when you have probably the top 3 best serves in the world alongside an Isner and alongside a Karlovic, that's going to automatically put you there. And the difference between a Karlovic and an Isner for him is he moves better, I think, than both those guys. He's got better groundies than both those guys. And he's even perhaps a little bit more nimble. I mean, I think Isner is a pretty good athlete, but he's just so tall that it's, you know, he's about 5 or 6 inches taller than Milo. So that's a lot. And same with Karlovic. And Karlovic is, you know, 36, 7 years old, too. It's not like the guy's a young guy. So that's going to slow him down. So I think those were that would definitely be, you know, the reasons why he is where he is. And he hits huge. I mean, he's obviously a very powerful guy. And he's a very, he's, you know, you talk about, like, Berdych professionalism versus Milos professionalism. And I would argue definitely that Milos is a much more professional guy. More than Tsonga, I mean, these guys are professional, but I think Milos, you know, this is a guy who works on what he has to do 8 hours a day, 9 hours a day. And I think those guys perhaps do not do that. So I think that's why he is where he is.
I mean, well pointed out. And so you can see that the difference there is pretty abundant, right? Like you pointed out athleticism and sheer power as 2 major differences in what and why he's number 3 in the world and those other guys aren't, with similar weaponry. And so now going forward, what's the difference between Djokovic, Murray, and Milos right now? And what you're seeing is what do you think, Nima? What's the major difference right now with Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic, and what is it? Is it the court speed? Is it the balls? Is it shot selection? Is it... you know, what is the true separate? Is it the way he plays his matches in the big moments? Is it, you know, why didn't he break through when he had an opportunity to break through? Those kinds of things. What do you think is holding him back besides hitting bigger second serves or playing a tad bit more aggressively throughout a calendar year?
Well, everything, I think, you know, as you grow in any profession, right, what gives you that edge on, you know, people who are younger, people who are, you know, coming in, whatever is experience, right? You've seen, you've been there and you've done that. You know, Djokovic knows how it feels to save break points in a Grand Slam final, you know, match points. You know, you saw a couple of years ago, remember he had that awesome return against Federer at the U.S. Open. Like, he's done stuff like that. Same with Murray. How many Grand Slam finals has Murray played? 10? 11? You know what I'm saying? Like, Milos has been in one. So the experience is a huge thing. And it's going to come down to a time where he has to do what he believes that he can do. Like, hit, like, let's say he has an opportunity on a match point or to get to a match point and he hits 125 mile an hour second serve ace down the line, which I think he has the ability to achieve, then that's going to give him confidence. So he has to do something to give himself that belief, because he has a lot of belief. Because you can ask him right now, what are your goals? He will undoubtedly look right straight through your eyes, into your eyes, because I know him and I've talked to him on various occasions, and he'll tell you, I want to be number one and I want to win a lot of Grand Slams. But he has to believe that he can do it. I think he wants to do it, but he has to do something so he can actually believe that it's achievable. And when it's right in front of you, you got to make it happen. And a guy like Murray or a guy like Djokovic, they're so solid. They don't have the biggest forehands, backhands, or serves in men's tennis. I think we can all agree with that. But what they have is they're solid as a rock, super athletic, they're liquid movement out there, and they don't miss anything. Like, look at Murray right now. How hard is it to hit a winner against him? How hard was it to hit a winner against Djokovic 6 months ago and throughout the last couple of years? How hard was it to hit a winner off Nadal when he was at his prime? I mean, these guys were just backboards. Like, it's like going and play against a wall at a local school, right? They're not missing anything. And that's what it comes down to. Milos is not like that, because if you can get him into a compromising position, you're going to get the ball past him regardless of his height, right? Because he doesn't move as well. And I think that's really what it comes down to. But ultimately, it comes down to belief. He has to be in a situation where, you know, destiny is, you know, right in his face. And it's like, look, what's your choice right now? Are you going to do it or you're not going to do it when he has that opportunity, especially on his own serve where he's controlling the tempo and the ball in his hand and he's going to throw that thing up, toss it up, and is he going to hit it? And if that happens, then I think he's going to start to believe and get over that hump. But it's never going to be an easy proposition, because throughout the history of tennis, we've never seen a super big server just dominant. Yes, we had Pete Sampras, who had a huge serve, but the guy was mega athletic and only about 6'6", 1. So he was amazing mover, exceptional volleyer, you know, and that's it. So he had so many different layers to his game that he could rely on. Even though, relatively speaking, his backhand was weak, he still had so many other layers that he could call upon, and he believed more than anything. And, you know, I remember this conversation part, I think this is important, that he had with Patrick McEnroe. Patrick McEnroe asked Sampras, he said, what is it that, you know, you get up to that line, you're playing Agassi, you're playing whoever your main rivals were at the time, and you got that serve, and you're hitting 117 mile an hour slice serve right on the line. And he goes, you know, Patrick, I can't describe it, but I just know that when I'm up there, I believe that I can make the shot. And I think that if you ask Milos that same question, he couldn't say yes. He couldn't say the same thing. And it's obviously evident that he can't do it, because if he could, he would have done it by now. So, and he's going to be 26 next month. This guy's not 18 anymore, right? He's been on the tour now for a long time. So I think ultimately it comes down to belief, comes down to experience, and it's that innate ability to believe that you can do things because of confidence, or, you know, you've proven it to yourself that you can make something happen. I think that's ultimately what it is for me.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
that's a complete answer if I've ever heard one. And maybe his journey, his Mount Everest climb is going to be in the next 3-4 years, which is right into his prime, his athletic prime, and no longer tennis has shifted now to other sports. And the athletic prime is pretty much 27 to 32, and looks like tennis is now there along with other sports. And we'll see. We'll watch the next 5 years and see what Milos can do. And And see how much interruption we get from guys like Del Potro and Wawrinka and Djokovic and Nadal and Federer. And I mean, I think it's an exciting time. 2017 is going to be pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think so. And to be honest, like, and I say this with all sincerity towards every player because, you know, I have respect for everybody. I really hope it's a more overall competitive season because this year we had Djokovic dominate the first half. We had Murray dominate the second half. Very similar games. They do a couple things differently. But Nadal was pretty much a non-factor this year. Federer was a non-factor. We had some great stuff from Del Potro. Still, I mean, he's 38 in the world. This is coming back from 1,040. So the guy increased his ranking by over 1,000 places in one season. So it's remarkable. And he didn't even really play a full season, right? He didn't play the French Open. I mean, this guy, like, it was incredible. And I think if we can get a guy like maybe Alex Zverev to creep up closer to the top 10, a guy like Jack Sock, Kyrgios, if he can get his act together, then we're really going to have some really good stuff happening next year. But if we have Murray and Djokovic in the finals of every Grand Slam and most Masters 1000s, to be honest, Parsa, for me personally, as a tennis analyst, whatever you want to call me, a commentator, you know, a writer, just like a fan, it's going to be pretty boring for me. That's my honest opinion. Not that I'm not going to watch, and not that I don't like either Djokovic or Murray, because I do, but I definitely want to see more variety at the highest level of these events. And, I mean, Stan is great to have him in there, but I want to see a little bit more if possible. And I know it's not easy, because it takes so much to get to the top of the mountain, but I want to see some of these younger guys come in and really push, you know, Murray and Djokovic and the like. And I'd love to see Federer get back into the top five. Same with Nadal. I think it's going to be extremely difficult because how gifted or whatever they are, that competitiveness and the just match play is very important to these types of players. And I think Federer is the one exception, but the only issue with Federer is he's, you know, 35 and a half. So, I mean, age is obviously going to be a culprit for him, but we'll see what happens. I mean, it's going to be, we're going to watch and we're going to see how it transpires. And, you know, we'll be back in a few weeks' time to give our highlights on 2016 as an overall and what we thought of the season and, you know, some of our personal highlights and, you know, favorite matches and whatever you want to call it. So, Parsa, with that said, if you have nothing else to add today, we'll wrap it up. Do you have any final words?
Not much. You know, I thought, you know, for an absent week or whatever it was, I thought the tournament was great again. I thought the doubles was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it was just fun to watch. And I thought the crowd was into it. And I thought it was just, London seems to work for the Euro Championship there. It's taken very seriously. It's like a big deal. And it feels like a superstar stage that is warranted. And hopefully guys can be healthy this time next year so that we can get all that you said, a mixture of all the top guns and the young guns and literally get the best eight players in the world instead of, you know, the best 12 or whatever it is, and let them duel it out and have some fun. And I think you're going to be happy with 2017, Nima. You know, I think there's going to be a lot more unbelievable round of 16 quarterfinal matches in the slams. I think there's going to be 16 players in the mix. I think this year there was, let's say, 7 or 8 players in the mix, you know, between your Nishikoris, Wawrinka. You didn't know how these guys were going to step up through the tournament. I think you're going to get all the way up to like a Jack Sock and those kinds of guys that are going to have shots at going far in slams. And I think you're going to get that. I don't know if you're going to get any different winners, Nima,
yeah,
to be honest with you, but you may not get Djokovic and Murray every single tournament at the end, and that would be a first step towards sharing the wealth and sharing the success.
Yeah, it's all about sharing the wealth. You got it, my friend. Okay, guys, so thanks everybody out there for listening. Parson and I will be back shortly in a few weeks to give our recount of the 2016 season for both the men and the women. In the meantime, for anybody looking to get down to the Australian Open in 2017, make sure to hit up Grand Slam Tennis Tours for all your ticket and traveling needs. In the meantime, make sure to hit up ParsaSammy at ParsaSammy at Twitter, myself at Tennis Connected. You can also follow Tennis Connected on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and you can download this podcast on iTunes as well. Parsa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, buddy.
And thanks everybody out there once again for listening. Be good. Enjoy the rest of fall. Hopefully it's not too cold for wherever you are, and we will speak with you in a few weeks' time.